Argentina under Javier Milei was supposed to be a libertarian success story. So why does it need a $20 billion bailout? What do libertarians think of that? That's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine, a libertarian magazine. Today, I am joined by Matt Welch, Nick Gillespie, and birthday king, Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy birthday, Catherine.
Happy birthday to my birthday queen, Peter Suderman.
I'm Peter Suderman. I'm your host.
Misgendering.
This is why libertarians can't win anything.
We can only win king of the podcast, and Catherine has that title forever. All right, so let's talk about this Argentina bailout situation. Nick, does this prove that libertarianism was wrong, that Javier Milei is implementing a program that does not work?
Clearly, right? No, I mean, nothing of the sort, which isn't to say he's not in a lot of political problems and things like that. But among other things, since Milei came to power, annual inflation went down from something like over 200% to 35% and continues to drop. They're showing basic fiscal surpluses. Things are working well. He's got political problems. And a big part of that is because the Argentine peso has always been worthless. This is a country who's had terrible, terrible governments going back for 100 years. And the one thing that I am troubled by in the U.S. bailout, or one of the things that I'm troubled by the bailout, besides the fact of it, is that what should be the main, premise of any American help is that Argentina do what Milei promised to do, which is to dollarize the economy. And two countries in Latin America, Ecuador and El Salvador, have done this in the recent past, and it has gone extremely well for both of them. So I hope, that becomes the main gist of American help in this instance.
So, Catherine, there's this clip going around of Trump being asked by a reporter what he has to say to American farmers, farmers who feel that Argentina is getting a better deal than they are here. And in response, this is what Trump says. Look, Argentina is fighting for its life, young lady. You don't know anything about it. You don't understand what that means. They are dying. I think he probably said they are dying again after. I don't know. I'm just making up that part. Are they dying?
I mean, Argentina is always kind of dying. It is rough down there. And I think a lot of what Milei has done is awesome. But the reason, to be clear, that American farmers are complaining is because Milei, faced with economic troubles, decided that a good thing to do might be to reduce tariffs. And so this has created a situation where Argentine soybean exports are more appealing to China. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on. It's very complicated, but still fundamentally kind of a libertarian move, except for the part about asking for handouts from America.
I feel like we should have a segment on the show that's just soybeans and rare earth minerals.
Yes.
Just every week, check in on what's going on with soybeans and rare earth minerals. And Matt can explain commodities trading markets to us.
Matt can probably explain soybeans better than rare earths, I think.
Soybeans. Not a soy boy.
I think that question, that I just read, it's sort of ridiculous. It's very Trumpian and all of this, but it does get at something here, which is that Trump's coalition is built around, maybe not entirely, but does not like foreign aid. Trump is the America First president. He is the guy who, if you are a foreign aid skeptic, you voted for Trump because he wasn't going to do that anymore. And here we are under Trump bailing out Argentina to the tune of $20 billion.
I'm not sure if you counted all of the foreign aid skeptics who made that their primary reason to vote, that would fit in this tiny room that I record this in. It's an element of Trump's winning coalition. I don't know if it's the dominant one at all. There's a difference between a bailout and a currency swap. This one is sort of in between those two, which is to say that a normal currency swap, which we have permanent currency swaps right now, that people I haven't registered a lot of people getting super upset about, Japan had like $225 billion worth of currency swap overhang during COVID financial crisis. We did a dozen of those too. So it's a kind of common instrument that is used. What makes this difference is that it's personalized and it's not really about contagion of a currency collapsing or a series of financial dominoes falling that could hurt the global economy. So this is more personalized, more deal making. So, of course, it's going to be more Trumpy. It goes against that. $20 billion is a day's worth of federal government spending. Alas, it should be more like $2. It's not gigantic in the scheme of things. Currency swaps are generally paid back. But the same reason that we should be skeptical about this being paid back is the same reason Argentina didn't dollarize, is that it's expensive. They just don't have foreign currency lying around. That's the whole point of this. And when there's a pressure on the peso, they freak out. So that's what we're seeing. So yes, this is going to resonate badly with Trump's base. Is that as important as just Trump? I'm skeptical about.
It's maybe not just $20 billion in a currency swap. There's additional reporting from the Washington Post that Scott Bessent is marshaling an additional $20 billion from banks and sovereign wealth funds beyond the $20 billion currency swap. It's very unclear exactly what that means, but we're maybe talking about doubling this now. Sorry, Nick, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Well, I was going to say, like, you know, you can't square this with Trump's America First emphasis and the reason why people like him. It's like, if we're cutting foreign aid, we're cutting foreign aid. And the fact that he is doing this because he explicitly said, you know, he wants Milei to win the midterm elections, and that if Milei doesn't win, they're not going to go through with any kind of aid or anything like that. That's not a good basis for international policy and again, the one thing that they could do to actually help Milei as well as help American taxpayers, if we're doing this, is to insist on dollarization, which can be done with virtually zero currency reserves, foreign currency reserves in Argentina. This is not a well thought out plan. It is not libertarian. I understand why Milei is doing it. And I understand why American farmers are upset, but they're getting upset at the wrong reason. If they voted for Trump because they like tariffs, that's the problem. Trump is screwing people over. America First policies are not good for American businesses. They're not good for American consumers. They're not good for anybody. So we can kind of split these into different ways and not be fully happy with any of them. But there's no reason to think that, like, oh, if only we weren't bailing out Argentina, you know, farmers would be doing well. No, they've lost their Chinese market. Which is a big problem. And as Catherine was pointing out, you know, it's like Argentina, one of the things Milei has done that has helped the Argentine economy is cut tariffs and import quotas and things like that and open up free markets. It's very dispiriting.
Okay, so Catherine, Nick says that this is not a good basis for international policy because Trump is explicitly tying this bailout to the reelection of Milei, and that makes it political. But let me just push back a little bit on that. If the isn't it incumbent, isn't it a good thing for the United States to help allies who are implementing good policy relative to, like, if the alternative to Milei is a terrible socialist government, isn't it not crazy to say we're going to help the guys who are basically trying to put things back on track and make things right, and we're not going to help the people who are going to make things much worse?
A lot of the reporting around this decision, both on the $20 billion and then on the mysterious other $20 billion that we don't really know anything about, it's about whether it's too little too late. And I think that is something that always troubles people who are critics of U.S. foreign policy, especially kind of this buying and selling of favors, is it's so often, I mean, Matt Welsh has written about this, it is so often the money following decisions that were already made. It's too little too late. It's lagging indicator. I'm skeptical that this money can or will save the election for Milei. And I'm deeply skeptical of the idea that I want a U.S. president trying to save an election, even for somebody that does seem friendly. I just don't trust presidents to have good judgment on that. And, this one, I happen to like Milei. I still think it's pretty cool that he exists. But the thing I like even more is U.S. presidents not manipulating other nations' elections.
There's Peter, to your question, there's Trump's very transactional and blunt way of putting this could arguably be seen as kind of a crasser extension of what the International Monetary Fund does, which, you know, when they gave a $20 billion stabilization loan or whatever it was not that long ago to Argentina, they give those things out when they see you doing reforms that they think are going to turn this thing around. Both the World Bank and the IMF, whatever one may think of them, they generally say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to try not to throw good money after bad. But if you're going to actually have some kind of fiscal discipline and turn your ship around, then this money is available to you. So it's not completely like beyond the pale in terms of the way that Trump is putting it. What makes it different is that it's not laundered through this international institution with which America has a lot of sway. It's made much more personal, like everything is with Trump, and potentially transactional, which is why we're seeing sovereign wealth funds being thrown in, which is, you know, it's just going to be the Saudi Arabian government or something like that. And, you know, some goodies or some promise to buy American this and that, that'll be thrown in there as well.
The IMF, but not the one run by Tom Cruise in the Mission Impossible movies, the Impossible Mission Force, the other one. Nick, take us out here. This, in some ways, it sounds like what you're saying and what I'm hearing from their group here is this is a bad look for Trump. But maybe it's not a bad look for Malay, and he has still done a whole lot of good things. I mean, is that basically right? Like, do you see Malay as still fundamentally a force for good and a force for libertarian good in Argentina?
Yeah, I mean, I see Malay as, you know, on the international stage as somebody who's good for libertarian ideas, and he's had, you know, significant success. He also, one of the reasons he's unpopular is, you know, there is, he's in a very small party that kind of had a miraculous victory when he won and got pulled into office. But he also has a bunch of scandals around him involving his sister and, you know, some kind of funny money deals and things like that. And again, the one thing that he needs to do to stabilize the economic system in Argentina is to get rid of the peso. Argentina has had like 9 or 10 major currency crises since World War II. And it's partly because their currency system sucks and nobody believes it. Dollarizing the economy would go a long way towards succeeding or putting into place libertarian goals, which is to take the money supply out of pure politics. It would stabilize. It would be hard, but it's doable. It's something he said he should do. And if he's going to lose anyway, he might as well push for this or make it part of the deal with the United States, because otherwise there's no reason. Like, the U.S. and U.S. taxpayers should not be on the hook for other countries' fiscal failures. You know, go through the IMF or the World Bank or whatever you want to do. But it's like, you know, this seems to me open and shut that Malay should go through with what he promised. And Donald Trump should start, you know, conducting foreign policy based on America's best interests, not on what he wants to do to feel good or look good in the moment.
Sometimes it seems like the U.S. taxpayer is not even on the hook for the America's fiscal failures. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Let's go take a break. And we'll be right back. Let me ask you a question. Do you trust your internet provider to respect your privacy? There's good reason not to. Depending on where you live, ISPs may be required to keep logs of your online activity. In the US, ISPs can legally sell your browsing history for profit. Good news is, you don't have to trust your ISP as long as you use ExpressVPN. Everyone needs ExpressVPN. Without it, a whole lot of third parties can see every website that you visit, even in incognito mode. Those third parties include your internet service provider, your mobile network provider, the admins of your Wi-Fi network, your school, your boss, your parents, whoever that might be. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers. That means third parties can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN is the best. It's easy to use, it hides your IP address, and it works on so many different devices. Phones, laptops, tablets, and more, so you can stay private on the go. ExpressVPN is rated number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. Trust me, if you're someone who doesn't want third parties looking at your online activity, like sometimes me, you need ExpressVPN. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/roundtable. That's expressvpn.com/roundtable to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months. Once again, that is expressvpn.com/roundtable. All right. The return of No Kings, No Kings 2, No Kings Harder. All right, all around the country this weekend, people gathered to protest Donald Trump. General focus on Trump as a threat to democracy, his ICE actions. In response, Trump this weekend posted what appears to be an AI-generated video of himself flying a fighter plane while wearing a crown and dumping what looks an awful lot like human feces on a crowd of maybe protesters in city streets. So I guess that's what Trump thinks of No Kings. Nick, you were at the protests this weekend. What did you think?
Yeah, I am happy to report that no aerial feces were dumped on anybody, or at least while I was there. So I think, Peter, you're hedging a little much. That was definitely an AI-generated video that was put out by Donald Trump on Truth Social, and he was dumping shit, you know, literally, if metaphorically, on protesters, which is really, you know, at a certain point, you got to wonder. Like, you thought when he was putting sombreros on Chuck Schumer's head and stuff like that and doing, you know, fake video and audio for that, that was like one way of getting to Mount Rushmore. This is he's really making the full application. To, you know, have, I don't know who would get blasted off, maybe George Washington, because, you know, George Washington really didn't seem to, you know, talk shit about people that much, literally or figuratively. But I went to the
and he didn't have a fighter plane.
Yeah, but he couldn't even dream of airplanes, really. But I went to the No Kings rally, and it was completely peaceful. It was, you know, it was massive. It was large. I'm not sure what the numbers were, but I was, you know, I went along on a bunch of BLM marches and COVID marches in Manhattan back in 2020. This was as big as that. It was unified in voice. There were, you know, nobody was really dragging in, you know, ancillary issues that needed to be aired in this. It was all just like, Donald Trump is terrible. Donald Trump is awful. We want to get rid of Donald Trump. I thought it was, to me, what was most interesting is New York City, where Trump is from, doesn't like Donald Trump. He lost in 2024. New York City voted 38 points against him. They voted for Kamala Harris by 38 percentage points. That's down from how Trump lost in 2020, where it was like 51 points or 52 points to Joe Biden, the difference. So people like him more. They liked him more in 2024. They seem to dislike him again. And it's, you know, that anger is meaningful. And it was not just in New York, it was all over the country. And I think there is a generalized dislike of him, which you see in his approval ratings, which are bad. They're back to where they were in his first term, and they're not getting better. And I think Trump can try to mock all of this. People, online trolls are certainly, you know, MAGA trolls are talking about, you know, these protests are fake, they're paid for, et cetera, they're violent. They're none of those things. And the Trump administration waves away the dissatisfaction with the state of the economy and the state of his policies, you know, at their own peril.
Matt, let's talk about the trolls and the kind of MAGA reaction to this. I saw a lot of Trump administration people in the orbit, supporters of President Trump online this weekend, really trying to downplay or make fun of it, just kind of rushing to mock the No Kings protesters. You have Based Mike Lee posting a video of people dancing at No Kings and writing, "Nothing says hip like rhythmless boomers trying to dance, all while trying way too hard to look like they are having fun." Well, okay, just like as a statement, maybe kind of true.
To interrupt, "Nothing says hip," sardonically says Based Mike Lee.
Yeah.
The senator from Utah.
Totally fair point. Also, boomers, though, you know, trying to dance. in matching T-shirts. It is. It's a little goofy. There are people who've called it cringe. There's a whole piece by Jerusalem Demsis in The Argument this morning about how it's not cringe, about how it's not, right? But what do you make of this kind of rush to mock this movement and the kind of the way that it has gone back and forth between saying, oh, these people are violent extremists trying to tie them to Antifa, and then when it's pretty clear that there is no widespread violence, there's no riots. I'm not saying that there was no misbehavior at all at any protest, but fundamentally, this was pretty peaceful. It was pretty, you know, corny. It was old people. What do you make of the kind of the shifting sort of attempts to attack the No Kings protesters?
People are just absolutely shameless, and if they've haven't scrubbed their own brains, they just of a recent memory of the Tea Party protests when the left was doing the exact same thing. They're finding the one nut. They're finding the one person holding the poster with Obama with a bone through his nose and saying, aha, these millions of people who came out were all there because of racism. And if they'd gone out to the mall, as we all did, or and gone out to any of these protests, they would have seen that that was not the preponderant vibe out there, as these things resembled nothing like Stephen Miller had anticipated that they were going to be. The administration keeps rooting for 2020 to break out of 2025 because they want to be able to say, see, Antifa and violence and media excuses thereof. And then you get instead dancing boomers, or even better yet, in the case of Portland, and I don't say those words together very often, people just dressed up in dinosaur costumes or riding bikes naked. Like, they keep doing this. By they, I mean people who are showing up in public. They keep failing to be the violent trans-Tifa, whatever the hells that people are making them out to be. And it sort of just renders a lot of the discourse around this ridiculous and at the same time very predictable, which is that it's all astroturfed. All of these human beings are there sort of like illegitimately. And again, this is a mirror image of what the left used to say about the Tea Party. Just, oh, the Kochs somehow did it all. It's ridiculous. And I'm glad to see two things. One, just the number of people out there, which is great, in terms of people who are protesting things like having ICE and the National Guard sent in over the wishes of local politicians to very heavy-handedly enforce immigration law with masks on, sometimes against U.S. citizens. That is bad. It's fine to say that that's bad. It's a good thing to protest. I'm glad that that happened. I'm glad of the branding. I see a lot of people mocking No Kings. I think it's pretty good. Like, I don't want a king. And Trump acts in a very monarchical way, as some of us, named me, have been saying for a long time now. And it's worth protesting. I just wish that the people doing it would then extend the logic a little bit further, especially on their own side.
Catherine, did the No Kings protest impact your life in any direct way? Say, for example, the attendance at your weekend yoga class?
Yes. So here's my thoughts about No Kings, which is that it is really, really bougie. And I think that that's like kind of gets at when people are like, oh, is it cringe? Is it not cringe? Is it like... there was a offshoot of the No Kings protest in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Just people kind of strung along Connecticut Avenue. Some of them were standing at a metro stop. Like, they could have just gotten on the metro and gone to the big one downtown. But they were like, nah, it's more convenient for me to protest here, which there's something, I don't know. I'm sort of
Chevy
charmed.
Chase is so nice.
It's very, very bougie. And I went to yoga this weekend on Sunday, and the folks at yoga were talking about how yoga class attendance was really way down on Saturday and Sunday morning, and that everyone agreed it was almost certainly because so many people were at the protests. And one lady said, yeah, I had to leave yesterday's yoga class early to make my protest sign. And then the other lady said, oh, you know, I'm a little embarrassed, but I actually just bought one because I didn't have time to make one. First of all, markets and everything. Hell yeah. Second, like, this is kind of what I mean. Like, I think you do have like these boomers in their you know, I also got invited to go to the No Kings protest, by the way. But let's stop for brunch first. Right? Like, when the protest also has brunch, I actually think that's a great thing. I think that's like a sign that things are going well in America, that we are not in a like fight for our lives, climb the walls, you know, Molotov cocktails moment. We're just in a, like, we got to explain that we're mad, but we could get Eggs Benedict
first. Doesn't that make it more mockable? In fact, that was the thing that people mocked in the first Trump term was protest is the new brunch.
Who are the people you're talking about, Peter? I mean, you know, is it Stephen Miller? Is it Benny Johnson?
No,
I mean,
I'm talking about just
hardcore Republicans or MAGA Trumpists are saying, oh, this is all bullshit. This is all bullshit. I don't see people coming out to march for Trump. And he's had a couple of events where it's like, here's my big military parade. Here's this, here's that. He's not pulling numbers. So I think the weakest part of the No Kings protests is that there is no focus on policy that actually will matter once you get past, you know, a kind of show of force or in numbers. The people that I talked to in New York, you know, and this is in the piece that is up at Reason, they, you know, when I asked them, what do you hate about Trump? Inevitably, they said everything. And then they would launch into, you know, he's a rapist. He's despicable. He's vile. He's fat. You know, he's old. He's bald. He's, you know, and like that, it, you know, you can't second guess the feeling behind that. But like, you know, just, you know, if we got rid of all presidents who were fat in American history, we'd have like 20 presidents, right? I mean, like, you need something more thoughtful or something that will actually extend forward into election season. And, you know, that I think is lacking. But like the idea that it's being mocked. Yeah, of course, it's being mocked by people who support Donald Trump.
Well, you know, look, the mockery, I think, is that what I'm getting at is that people are saying that this is a social movement, that it's about sort of a fitting in with your class, that it's not really about anything. And in some ways, that actually goes to your point, which I thought was really salient in the piece that you wrote and just what you said, which is that there isn't a policy ask here. I mean, to the extent that there is, it is, about ICE and about the deportations, which is great. I think everybody here on this podcast thinks that what Trump is doing there is bad. But this is a policy light protest movement that is mostly about sort of fitting in, social signaling, a kind of, you know, sort of like, it's very bougie, as Catherine said. And that is part of, I think, what makes people think
why
that it's not
that,
in some sense,
why
serious.
Why is that funny? Or why would we dismiss that? If, you know, if literally millions of people are willing to go to the streets to say, I don't want to live under a king, and Trump is the one who proclaimed himself king.
Come on, you know. You know why people make fun of brunch and mimosas and this kind of particular way. Like, that's not, this is a thing that is, that people like to mock. And I am not saying even that I necessarily agree with this.
It's similar to the way that people mocked the kind of like, hands off my Medicare. But also there was a class element of the way that people mocked Tea Party protests. And that was gross, too. Like, oh, look at these trailer trash coming out or thereabouts. You would see that kind of mockery coming from sort of elite and Democratic circles. And it's just gross. I mean, the amount of group demonization and collectivization and like, I'm going to dismiss these number of millions of people because I'm going to assume that they all have the same identity that is mockable is one of the fundamental sicknesses that we have right now in our politics. And I think the proper response to it, unless it's really funny, is to dismiss it out of hand as cheap opportunism.
I also think there is this element of a lot of the major protests in my memory, if they don't start out as policy light, they end up as policy light, right? So in some ways, this one feels to me like it's just accelerated that process a little bit. You know, the whatever Black Lives Matter protests, like, you know, we at Reason got excited. We were like, oh, cool. Are we going to do policing reform? We were not. Turned out we were not really going to do that. We were just going to be mad. And there were lots of things to be mad about. But like in the end, it was just about being mad. And again, some kind of in-group signaling for sure going on there. Tea Party, same problem. It was like, oh, are we gonna be excited about fiscal discipline? No, we're actually just going to be mad. And then there's going to be a long, weird journey. And like somehow this is going to end in the election of Donald Trump. So I think in some ways we just don't like the vibes. We don't like the monarchical energy that's going around these days aspect of the No Kings. It just skips right to that part. Also, though, the real policy ask is release the Epstein papers, if the signs that I can see are any indication. So there's that.
All right. So on the flip side of this, though, just to sort of push one more, just to push back a little bit more here on the policy part of this, I've seen a bunch of conservatives, people on the right, some of them even like people who are Trump skeptical, not MAGA heads, nothing like that, say, look, I would take these people much more seriously if I weren't pretty sure that most of them were on the side of overreach, executive overreach during the COVID era under Biden, that many of the people who are out there protesting Trump's executive overreach and the way that Trump is acting like a king, and I think he absolutely is in a bunch of ways. But many of the people who are protesting that now, they're not asking for policy, and they're just asking for a different guy. And when the last guy did his king stuff, they were okay with that.
Well, this really reached its peak, right, at the moment when we had the vaccine resistor movement and the overturn of Roe v. Wade happen at the same time. And we had the two different opposite sets of protesters saying that they wanted the government's hands off of their bodies. Like, this is where we are now. It's you know, sometimes people say the right words. You know, there's this new Gallup poll that says that 61% of Americans think that government has too much power. Great. But the reason that those numbers are being driven that way is because there's a bunch of Democrats shifted into the government has too much power box. They're going to shift back out when their guy's in charge again. I think, unfortunately, this is just the nature of things. This is like, yes, of course, there's hypocrisy here. There's hypocrisy everywhere. That's all of politics.
I would add to that, though, there's a Gallup poll that just came out saying 62% of Americans also want a third party. They think we need a third party, which is also being driven by, you know, the obvious fact that Democrats and Republicans have controlled every aspect of government for a long time. But over the past decade, it spiked up, and it spiked up recently under Trump. I think our job, Peter, is not to, convince conservatives, particularly Trump-leaning conservatives, that, oh, you better take this seriously. There's a massive opportunity here because a lot of the people who were, who were walking or protesting or, you know, on their scooters, in the No Kings rallies, you know, after brunch, they were in favor. I'm sure they were in favor of lockdowns. I'm sure they were in favor of COVID mandated vaccines and all of that kind of stuff. But there is an opportunity now for a chunk of those people to understand, oh, yeah, within recent memory, Biden was terrible when he acted this way. Trump is terrible when he's acted this way, to the extent that libertarians can peel off a number of those people. So the next time there's an opportunity, we can actually have people who are principled voters on the size, scope, and spending of government. That will be good. I mean, it's kind of amazing to me. Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, and whatnot, just tweeted today, Thomas Massie for president. Massie is a libertarian Republican who Donald Trump is trying to primary, who AIPAC is trying to primary. To the extent that if we come out of this cycle of bougie revolt with, 5% more people being committed to principled limited government ideology, that's a great win. But we don't have to convince every troll on Twitter that, you should just ignore this because those people are really kind of full of shit.
All right. So speaking of size, scope, and spending of federal government, do we even have one? Not really anymore, kind of. We're still in a partial government shutdown, and it's not clear when it's going to end here. And partly that's because Democrats don't really seem to have a strategy, and partly because Trump himself doesn't seem to mind that the government is shut down. And one of the reasons he doesn't seem to mind is that it is empowering him to do stuff he wants to do. He's made attempts to fire federal workers, although that's tied up in the courts already. He's talking about shutting down Democrat programs, cutting funding to Democratic states. So Matt Welch, is part of what's going on here that when Democrats chose to shut down the government because they needed to do something to protest Trump, did they just give Trump an opportunity to expand presidential power?
Probably. He has a freer hand. The biggest thing is Rand Paul, who's another Republican who's in the crosshairs of Donald Trump this week. I think he called him a wacko. We're back to the wacko birds. Glad to see that. A deep cut coming back. But what Rand Paul pointed out is that we have had, and this is very consistent with what Justin Amash and other people have been saying for more than a dozen years, is that we've had successive bipartisan Congresses that have willingly ceded with a C-E-D-E-D thing, power to the executive branch and haven't done their job. And so, yeah, that's when in a time when government is not being funded, the president, the executive branch is going to have some more power. The other aspect of this that I'm beginning to think about now as this really boring shutdown keeps stretching out in the future, I keep wondering, like, are Americans going to start going, huh? When's this going to affect me?
You know? So this is actually where we're going to go with this, because that was supposed to be the question that was going to end the shutdown. And part of what Trump is doing is paying the troops, for example. This was going to be a big choke point, a pivot point in the shutdown. And he's doing it in ways that are not obviously legal, just moving around money that isn't necessarily directly authorized or appropriated by Congress. It seems like Trump is making efforts to ensure that people don't feel the pain so that he can keep doing king stuff, so that he can keep sort of ruling without having any kind of congressional check, not that Republicans are going to do anything. And this takes Democrats out of power. And it just sort of says, well, look, the executive is what we have left. Catherine, how exactly is he able to do all of this? Is there going to be a check?
It seems real, real illegal to me. This is, you know, I am no expert, but
you're kind of an expert. You live in Washington.
It actually has reached a level where the kind of intricacies of some of these questions are beyond me. And I think that means that they are therefore beyond basically all Americans. Right. There's just because I'm smart, Matt.
Because you are an elite bougie yoga lady.
Have a birthday and kind of let it go to your head. Go on.
This is, you know, I'm trying really hard to pay attention. I'm following all the details. I literally get paid to do it. And it's still hard to see how exactly this is going to shake out because, yes, it seems like, you know, shutting down the government and then saying like, oh, don't worry, I'm just going to take this pot of money over here and pay the troops so that no one gets mad. That is exactly the kind of thing that government shutdowns are designed not to permit. And yet here we are. And I think that, you know, there really is a case to be made if he shuffles around a few more things and like, I don't know, are the national parks closed now? I feel like that's always the thing. So they'll like reopen the national parks. Those are somehow essential workers. And then the rest of America will forget that the government is closed and just get used to it. That will not, sadly, be a win for liberty. That will just be a win for discretionary executive power over funds that he has no right to control.
Nick, the other thing that Trump and J.D. Vance, vice president, are saying is that, well, what we're going to do here is we're just going to use tariff funds. And it seems like two things are true there. One is that's not happening. They're just lying about that. And even if they wanted it to happen, it would be illegal. Is that right? I mean, how is this going to play out? Who is going, like, what is going to happen here in terms of the funding? Because it just seems like the White House doesn't actually have any interest in ending the shutdown, because as long as the government is shut down, Trump has a freer hand to do the things that he wants to do.
Yeah. And that includes, by the way, bombing Venezuelan fishing boats, which is one of the things that Rand Paul is extremely exercised about and is the type of action that Trump is taking that is going to flip, I think, a lot of people who are in the middle of the road to say like, okay, yeah, this guy is acting, you know, he's a mad bomber in chief. This is kind of screwed up. One I would say is that the Democrats did not shut the government down. The Republicans control, you know, both houses of Congress. They shut the government down by not passing a budget resolution. And you can say, oh, well, you know, the Democrats didn't go along with everything they wanted. They are in the driver's seat and they can end it. They don't seem to need to do that. And Democrats don't need to do that. I don't know how it's going to end.
Well, there is a filibuster. And they need Democratic votes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Democratic pundits,
but just
really quick, Democratic pundits and elites spent weeks, maybe months, talking about how they needed to shut down the government because that was the choke point, the place where they could do something to show that they were opposing Trump. It's really hard to say that Democrats have no fault here, given that they talked about how they wanted to do this
for weeks in advance of doing it. The Republicans had every opportunity and they, you know, they can build a coalition. It's kind of like, you know, if you don't have a filibuster proof, majority, then you have to negotiate and compromise. And the Republicans weren't willing to do that, you know, particularly on the Obamacare subsidies, which should be ended. And Obamacare should have been ended when the Republicans were in control of Congress. And, you know, you can go on and on. But I'm just saying, like, to uncritically buy into the line that the Democrats have shut down the government is wrong. Because, the Republicans are willing to spend money on all sorts of shit. They're willing to do all sorts of stuff, and they didn't want to do this one thing. And, you know, this is the Democrats have bargaining power. So what I'm getting at, though, ultimately is who knows how this is going to end. The last government shutdown lasted 35 days. It did not end well for the Republicans, who were the party in power when it happened. I can't imagine this is going to end well for the Republicans. And one thing is for sure, it's all of the illegal moves that Trump is trying to do are going to be challenged in court, and they're going to be found to be illegal. And then the American taxpayers will end up paying, as they always do, they'll end up paying back pay and interest and things like that. And this will be a bad outcome all around.
I mean, there are polls that are showing that Democrats, you know, are getting through, that the Obamacare subsidies are popular, that people want them to be extended. I don't think anybody here on this podcast agrees with that. But there are also some polls showing that as the shutdown goes on, it's Democrats aren't obviously winning this standoff here. In fact, it just sort of seems like people are blaming everyone in the government kind of equally at this point, which may be somewhat close
to
the truth.
That's not a bad thing.
All right, let's take a break here, and then we're going to come back with a listener question on what we would do if we had a magic wand for policy here. You know those nights when you just don't sleep, and the next day you're dragging, you're exhausted, everything just feels harder? That is where CBD from CB Distillery can make a real difference. And it's not just sleep. CB Distillery has solutions that work with your body to help with stress, to help with pain after exercise, even mood and focus. And it's all made with the highest quality clean ingredients. No fillers, just premium CBD. Imagine waking up rested or enjoying your day without those nagging aches and pains. That is the real win of CBD Distillery's solutions. That's why over 2 million people trust CB Distillery. I'll get kind of personal here. I've had trouble sleeping since I was a kid, but CBD gummies help, and CB Distillery products are some of the best that I've tried. They calm the mind, they ease the tension, they just make it easy to fall asleep. So if you are ready for better sleep, less stress, and feeling good in your own skin again, try CBD from CB Distillery. And right now, you can save 25% off your entire purchase. Visit CB Distillery and use promo code REASON. That's cbdistillery.com. Promo code REASON, cbdistillery.com. All right. As a reminder, we love to answer your questions. Please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long question to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. We love to read your emails and answer your questions. This week's comes from Dion, who writes, if we could wave a magic wand and live in a truly libertarian country, what checks and balances would we even have against the type of power-leeching central government that has grown in the United States over the past 250 years? Is a live-and-let's-live society sustainable, or does every society eventually yearn for a king? Catherine, I don't think you yearn for a king, but society does, man. Sometimes we live in a society, and it wants a king. What do you say about that, King Catherine?
I think that all political orders are unstable, and that just because freer political states of organization sometimes collapse into tyranny does not mean that those things are impossible or unsustainable, because also tyrannies collapse in all kinds of ways on their own. Yes, of course, there will forever be people who want to be kings and people who want kings. This is built into human nature. But I believe that that there are, there is such a thing as a correctly balanced and liberal political order that can last a long time. And I think the American experiment, imperfect though it may be, is an awfully impressive one that has lasted a pretty long time.
Nick Gillespie, do people yearn for kings?
No, I don't think so. Unfortunately, the people who want to be kings often are more motivated than the people who want to live and let live. But I don't think there is a policy that you can just wave and say, okay, this will keep power decentralized. There are ways that you could make that more likely. One of the things, this idea You know, when I was talking about the dollarization of the Argentine economy, one of the things that Friedrich Hayek talks about in various places is separating the amount of money that is spent from the people who get to spend it, so that you don't have a legislature that is in charge of saying how much it's going to spend and also in charge of how much money it prints. That could be interesting. I don't know exactly how you would do that in an American context. It's easier to do if you're Ecuador or El Salvador and you say we're pegging our money to the dollar, because then you don't have the same control over it. But ultimately, it rests in the in the hearts and minds of every American. And like, this is, you know, to the extent that we are a creedal nation, we need to rehearse and revise and revive the narratives that where we talk about why it is better that if you live in New York State, it is a radically different experience culturally and economically and governmentally from living in Pennsylvania or New Hampshire or something like that, and really get to that and level off what the federal government can do. So it's doing fewer things that maybe should be done nationally. But I think that's, you know, that's the real check and balance is an ideal decentralized dispersed power, pluralism, tolerance, not just in the way we live, but how we fund government, what we fund, and all of that kind of stuff. And that's the hardest part of it all, is to keep that going over time.
So the overtime aspect, I think, is key here, Matt. I mean, part of the way this argument often gets expressed when you hear this is that that Western democratic governments build up layer upon layer of technocracy and bureaucracy and red tape and just sort of systems that end up being creaky. They don't work. And in modern America, in Europe, they also end up being pretty left wing because the bureaucracy, for various reasons, just ends up being more left leaning than certainly than the country as a whole, and just kind of having that left cultural valence. And so you end up having this kind of Yarvinite, Curtis Yarvin, you know, worldview. Sometimes it's not, you know, not necessarily attributed to him, but he is kind of the most notable spokesperson for it at this point. That's like, what we need is a strong and powerful leader to break through that. Now, I take it you disagree because you're not a king's guy, but if we don't need a king to break through that, what is the way to do it?
I think this, your question departs quite significantly from the listener's question, which was to imagine a utopian libertarian governing scenario, which I think is not that hard to imagine. You can limit how much a government and by what means a government can take in and spend if you were starting from scratch. So it's more difficult now to do that. You're right that there's these self-perpetuating bureaucracies, and they would, regardless of the political tilt of them, they are incentivized, and you people live in Washington, at least the birthday aspect people live in or near Washington. You're painfully familiar with the idea of, whoa, shoot, we better spend all this money before the fiscal year is up so that we can get the 2.3% increase next year. It seems like, you know, that old Mitch Daniels zero-based budgeting or whatever the hell has something to speak for it. It's very difficult to get in the American context, a new like constitutional amendment saying that you can't do X kind of tax or you can't spend this much more than GDP. But there are other countries that find interesting ways to do it. Like Switzerland has a very interesting power sharing aspect to their constitution, that a power has to be split between political parties in a certain way, and also has a spending cap on it. I don't think that, there's the Curtis Yarvin thing, is that there's a perpetual temptation. We see it a lot. We see this among a lot of libertarians, including especially uppercase L libertarians, where you get so impatient that you can't get the thing that you want, that you start taking crazy shortcuts, which usually have to do with cozying up to somebody in power or proximity to power, and then pretending that you can safely ignore 85% of what you spent your lifetime advocating for. That is a perpetual problem with with politics in general. The U.S. Constitution has done better than almost any other to understand that, and also understand the underlying temptation to go towards a kingly type of solution when you have that impatience. So we need to rediscover patience for most things, but maybe an impatience by how quickly we are going to get ourselves into a really bad sprawling fiscal crisis and having to deal with that for, you know, our kids' generation, at least.
All right. Since you bring up the Constitution, that is a good segue to our next topic, which is the drug boats, or maybe they're just fishermen, where in the Constitution, Catherine, does it say that you can just bomb drug boats? Maybe they're not drug boats, though. Maybe they're just a guy who fishes sometimes and you kill him. And that seems bad, right?
The Trump administration argument seems to be the Constitution says it's fine that we do that as long as we first just say out loud the magic word terrorists. We just say they're terrorists and then it's fine. Matthew Petty has written about this. His work was cited on the floor by Rand Paul, who in turn said the word smithereens about 40,000 times, which was awesome. And he was objecting to this very behavior because, in fact, it is not true that you can just kind of point at and this gets to what we were talking about earlier in the podcast. You cannot just point at a demographic group, at a cluster of people and say they are the enemy and we are at war with them. So it's fine. Everything I do after that is fine. Me, the president. It's still not fine. And I think that what we are seeing is this sort of gradually trickling out information, not only about the specific victims of these bombings, some of whom do seem to be drug smugglers, but some of whom seem to be fishermen, Joe Schmoes. Also, that the line between drug smuggler and fisherman, not as bright as you might think. Third, as I've sort of, you know, as the story has been unfolding, one thing that seems really clear is even if these are drug smugglers, it is extremely unlikely that the people in those waters are smuggling drugs into the United States. Like, the whole world has its own drug trade. We are not the only buyers and sellers of drugs, for Christ's sake.
And there's another country besides America?
There are other countries besides America. I don't know if you guys know this, but in those countries,
at the top of the show,
people consume a bunch of cocaine and marijuana, which seems to be what is actually on most of these ships, and none of it particularly obviously bound for the United States, given that the justification anyway is overdose deaths, which are mostly attributable to fentanyl, which doesn't seem to be on the, like, it just gets more and more complicated. You get more and more down the rabbit hole. And the idea that you can simply say they are terrorists, it's fine to kill them, is such an absurd oversimplification of a very complicated situation that I do think Americans have questions. Americans are a little skeptical about this to the extent that anyone is paying attention.
But that's what Trump likes to do, right? Is he likes to absurdly oversimplify everything. And that's where we get all of these memes from. That's where we get the fighter plane dropping shit while you're wearing a crown meme, is because that's how he perceives all of this. And that's where we get the memes about the drug smugglers. I think it was today, Matt Welch, you posted in our Slack a Trump meme that just was like a map of the Gulf of Mexico. Sorry, the Gulf of America. Except Trump had relabeled it once again the Gulf of Exploding Cartel Members. So, Matt, what do you make of the memification of presidential politics and that being the medium by which the president is communicating his worldview, his values, his goals? I don't know, not constitutional logic, like legal arguments, but this is now how he is doing public communication, is AI shit bombing memes and Gulf of Exploding Cartel Members jokes.
I worry more about bomb bombs than meme bombs. And the bomb bombs are murdering people who could be stopped. We have the ability. I think that we have, if I'm not mistaken, a sizable Navy that has the ability to interdict. Is that how you say that, Nick? Nick knows everything about interdict.
Big fan.
Saw them open for Kraftwerk in 1982.
Philip K. Interdict is my favorite sci-fi novelist.
We can stop the boats and say, hey, what do you got on the boat?
Yeah.
And they could say, hey, you're in international water. We could say, we don't care. The Monroe Doctrine and son rather. That's still a hell of a lot better than blowing them up to death, which is what we're doing. And it's an absolute shame. And we should be embarrassed as Americans, and as should be the people who are out there supporting this kind of stuff, like saying, like, oh, so you love drug smugglers, you love narco terrorists in the Maduro regime, you love socialist Venezuela. That's the quality of the discourse. And there will come a day when people will pretend that they weren't in favor of this and making arguments, apologizing for this type of absolutely untrammeled, murderous American power. That day is not today. We're going to see stupid memes for a long time. And I hope that people get more upset about the actual power that's being exerted rather than the stylistics associated with it.
Nick, I want you to wrap all of this up, like this whole podcast here for us, right? So we've got the Argentinian bailout. We've got the Trump as king memes and the no kings protests. We've got the consolidation.
Kenny Loggins danger zone in the shit dropping AI video.
You are going to take us into the danger zone. And then you're going to take us out of it, right? We've got the consolidation of power during the shutdown, right? All of this budget bullshit in which he is just moving around money in ways that are at best sort of dubious and maybe just flatly unconstitutional.
Against all odds, that the next Kenny Loggins song Trump uses is the theme from Flashdance. Or not Flashdance, excuse me, Footloose.
Although I hope. Yes. I mean, yeah, we're going to get that,
you know.
We're going to get that as the music
dancing
over.
Is no longer allowed. You know,
we're going to get that
as a boomer. He probably doesn't like to dance that much. I don't know. Am I wrapping it up?
Yeah, you're wrapping it up. Like this is this. There's a pattern here.
Specifically about the boats and Venezuela, like Trump is doing this, I assume, and I might be giving him too much credit, he is trying to send a signal to the generals and to the army in Venezuela to get rid of Maduro, you know, for a variety of reasons. Maduro is horrible. He is Chavez without the charisma. He's just a thug. He should be gone. The United States, whenever it starts getting over-connected or over-involved in Latin American politics, it never does the right thing. We are almost always on the wrong side of history. You know, and I'm not putting, you know, bailing out Argentina on the same level as, you know, defending United Fruit Company in Nicaragua or anything like that. But it's like we need to stop. There are reports that the CIA is starting up again, doing a lot of work in Latin America. This is never good. And, you know, Matt mentioned in passing the Monroe Doctrine, which has no actual force whatsoever. This is something that I believe our shortest president asserted, that we, you know, the United States has more control over what happens in South America and in the Caribbean than European countries do. We have not done well by that. And Trump gunning down boats or, you know, blowing up boats to smithereens or whatever, this is not a good thing. And it is all part and parcel of a guy who has no restraints, who has no understanding of or appreciation for the procedural checks and balances on power, which is fundamental to what libertarians believe, but what Americans believe in. And I think the more that he persists in this kind of behavior, and it extends to just paying whoever he wants during a government shutdown, to bailing out countries, whether or not the particular processes are done, everything he does, the more that he does that, he will become less and less popular. And that is a good thing, because we do not believe in kings here. And kings tend to want to have absolute power. And absolute power is a bad deal. So, amen.
All right, let's finish with our own King Catherine. What have you been watching, consuming, otherwise watching in the cultural arena this week? What do you want to recommend to us on your birthday?
I have been preparing to go to a Liberty Fund conference that is called Jefferson Through the Eyes of Madison. And it couldn't be more timely, guys. It's the 250th anniversary of the U.S. of A. It's No King's Weekend. And so what I want to recommend to you is that you get your hands on some of the letters between Jefferson and Madison. There's a collection of them called The Republic of Letters, The Correspondence Between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. There's a bunch of volumes. You'll be surprised to learn. Just delightful. Jefferson's letter to Madison from 1787, a few words on the Constitution. Just like, it's just really fun to watch these two dudes try to figure out how to make America be a thing that works. I feel like it's relevant to all the questions we've talked about on the podcast today, just in terms of like, no matter how carefully you construct your liberty protecting society, things are always going to go in an unanticipated way. you know, I think listeners to this podcast are already sophisticated enough to know that there is no such thing as the founders, that they're, in fact, a bunch of lunatics who all disagreed with each other all the time and kind of hated each other personally.
It's like they had a podcast.
Like, basically, that is what I suggest to you, is you read Madison and Jefferson's letters in the spirit of, like, if these bros had a podcast, what would be on it? And the answer is it would be a great podcast. So my suggestion to you, get totally up in the business of some of America's founding fathers, and especially on this question of the very, very high ideas of liberty embodied in the Declaration of Independence and the nitty gritty, messy reality of writing a constitution.
Nick, do you have any very high ideas for us?
I spent the past couple of weeks with the passing of Diane Keaton, doing a quick review of some of her lesser known movies, or more forgotten ones, because, you know, she's obviously best known for her role in The Godfather and Annie Hall, I would say. And those are very different roles, but they really show her range and power as an actress and as a kind of cultural figure, particularly in Annie Hall. She kind of created a whole type of female identity as well as a dress style that is still with us. I unfortunately went at movies that I had either not seen or not seen in a long time that were not very good, such as Little Drummer Girl, which is a mid-80s movie based on a John Le Carré novel where she plays an annoying, super pro-Palestinian American actress working in England, who then gets, through a series of really uninteresting contrivances, ends up working for the Mossad to unmask a Palestinian bomber and things like that. It is,
this is like a Candace Owens podcast.
Terrible. It is more terrible than you can possibly imagine. So I recommend watching it, because you won't feel, you'll be like, oh, that wasn't as bad as I expected it to be. And then I also watched Manhattan Murder Mystery, which is a late 80s movie, a Woody Allen movie. I think it was the last one she did with Woody Allen, where Diane Keaton plays a woman married to Woody Allen. And they're kind of going through a midlife empty nester crisis. And then they think they discover that their neighbor in their apartment building may have murdered his wife. And it starts out as a fantastic kind of semi-serious study of, like, of a woman in a midlife crisis just losing meaning in her life, and how is she going to find it again? And then it becomes a really kind of stupid caper movie, which features Alan Alda in that moment where he started to turn back into being a good actor after just being annoying as hell on MASH for so long. And it's, what's interesting about it kind of historically is this was a role written for Mia Farrow, but right before they started shooting, like a week before, Woody and Mia had their massive falling out. So he had to recast, and he recast Diane Keaton right away. And their chemistry is actually pretty good. And the other Diane Keaton movie I watched, which I continue to recommend, is her 70s movie. And it might have been her first full star turn, where she was the lead of the movie, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which is an absolute gimlet-eyed a depiction of 70s swinger, not swinger culture, singles culture, where she plays a first grade or kindergarten teacher who goes out every night and gets drunk just to fuck whoever she can find. It is the debut of, among others, Richard Gere, LeVar Burton, Brian Dennehy, and Tom Berenger. It is an incredible capsule summary, not of the kind of liberation of the 70s sexual revolution, but the anxiety that it inspired. It's based on a novel by Judith Rossner, which is incredible. The movie is creepy and disturbing, and it is like the Reefer Madness of sexual liberation. At the minute that somebody thinks about getting laid, you know bad, bad, bad things are going to happen. So, and she's great in it. It's a very weird and disturbing movie.
So it had like a horror movie logic to it, right? Like if the teens who have sex always get killed first. Yeah.
No, without exception. It's, and you also see that in movies like Eyes Wide Shut, where, you know, becoming sexually aroused is like, okay, that's like, you need to be punished. It's a very interesting movie for that reason. And perhaps we should, you know, remember Diane Keaton doing what she did best, which was being strangled and threatened by serial rapists in Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
I am furious at your First Wives Club erasure.
Here. Yeah, it's a good movie.
That's a fine film.
That was mentioned in the New York Times obit in the headline. Matt Welch?
So only 3 decades too late, I finally watched Ken Burns' baseball documentary for the first time. I didn't watch it for all those years because I'd seen snippets of one episode, and I was very, very worried that it was going to be some really treacly and awful nostalgia, which I hate almost as much as I love baseball. So, and I come from the future or the past to report that it is much better than I feared and exactly as bad, I think. The much better part is that the footage that they get of especially early baseball is tremendous. Like someone who marinates in that stuff, I hadn't seen many, many of these clips. So that was really nice. This is early in his career. It's one of his first big heaves. I think the Civil War was the first one, and I'll watch that someday too. His little kind of ornamentation and structures of it. There's the national anthem played at the beginning of each episode. Each episode is an inning that's dedicated to a decade. Other little kind of structural gimmicks are great, actually. And he doesn't do that as often as he goes on further in his career, since I have obviously been consuming a lot of that stuff lately. What I would like to suggest, that there's a problem there that you see in a lot of documentaries, which I will call the springtime for history problem, which is, and I mean that, like, remember when you were in high school and the history teacher was going to take you through, we're going to learn everything. And then, like, it's May, and we're only in 1920, and they just sprint. The sprint that back in my day only got us to just before the Vietnam War, because that was kind of complicated. But like everything that was super interesting, they just go, that happens in...
Did they play We Need a Montage?
It's super montage-y. No, the final episode of that, instead of keep going, like, you know, the 60s gets its own episode. The 50s, God help us. It's a bunch of East Coast bias, which is the other thing I was really worried about. Poor St. Louis fans and Sam Usual. But
yeah, baseball on the West Coast in the 50s was so great, Matt.
There's another part of the country, Nick, besides the East Coast and the West Coast. I'll leave you some time to think about what part of that country.
If I'm remembering correctly,
that
they spent a lot of time
be.
Talking about the St. Louis Cardinals.
They don't. They just go 70s, 80s, and half of the 90s in the last episode in a cram. This also happens in Rick Burns' Great New York documentary. So that's a problem. Stop doing springtime for history. Stop sprinting through the last interesting bits because the 70s is awesome. We should just, and Nick will agree with me here, that should have been a 75-part series just on the Afros and windbreaker under jerseys of 1970s players. But it's great. Baseball is great. Watch the playoffs and watch this documentary at the end.
Who are you?
I'm still just reeling
for
here.
Matt Welch in the playoffs, Matt Welch.
Mariners, I would love to see them win.
The two things you talk about most in this segment of the podcast are Ken Burns and baseball.
Yes.
But you hadn't seen the movie Baseball by Ken Burns.
I was also gone for the 1990s. So like I haven't ever watched a Seinfeld episode. There's a lot of gaps in my except for the last one, which was really terrible.
All right. So I also watched a movie, After the Hunt. This is the post Me Too provocation from Luca Guadagnino.
Wow.
Luca Guadagnino.
Okay,
is he having a stroke?
Holy cow. Yeah. Try it again. Let's just see what happens.
You can do it. Go ahead.
It is a post Me Too provocation from Luca Guadagnino, who's a pretty good director, kind of a scallywag. And this movie has Julia Roberts. She plays a Yale professor who is a moral philosopher who studies ethics. And she is put in a difficult situation when one of her students reports a sexual assault to her. The details are left unclear, but it is by another professor who she has a history with, played by Andrew Garfield. And so the whole movie is about what she is going to do, put in this position of not exactly knowing what really happened between the two of them. And to be clear, you never find out in this film. The film is never lets the viewer know exactly what happened, whether there was an assault at all, Part of the complication is the professor who is accused of the assault seems to know and was apparently going to confront this student with the fact that her PhD thesis looks like it was plagiarized. OK, so again, what do you do here? And this is a movie about the way in which Me Too put an awful lot of people in a position of having to choose sides and having to make a statement, a definitive, strong statement on an ethical statement, you might even say. About one side or another without being, not just without knowing, but without being able to know what was going on. And then what happens as a result of that? Well, this movie is set at Yale, and it's very much a kind of attack on the brunch-going yoga, like yoga class of human beings who we were talking about earlier, because it is attack on the kind of the elite bourgeois. And what it basically says is, all of these people, they study ethics, they study morals, they are the professionals who know, who can just quote chapter and verse from every philosopher. They know exactly, right? They're the super knowledgeable people who have made this their life study. And what do? When they are put in this position? Instantly, immediately, every single time, they choose whatever is expedient for protecting themselves. It is entirely about sort of maintaining your social class, about maintaining your status. And there's nothing at, there's no moral or ethical concerns about it. And so it is this very interesting kind of mean-spirited look back at what the hell we were doing 5 years ago or so. And there's a fascinating coda in this movie. I don't want to spoil too much, but it's really... it's set right now, basically, and it sort of looks back to just before the pandemic, at the height of Me Too, before the pandemic concerns kind of subsumed a bunch of that. And it just says, it just basically says, well, that was crazy. And it kind of was, right? Like, there was just so much craziness in the air. And it's fascinating to see this movie and Eddington, another movie about pandemic era craziness, about what the hell were we doing 5 years ago? And there's a way in which it's starting to feel with this and these two movies in particular, but some others that have touched maybe less directly on these themes, like that period of time is going to end up being for this generation what Vietnam was in the 1980s, where in the 1980s, you were just constantly seeing whether it was in actual war movies or not, just like sort of everything was this reflection, this long echo, this lingering sort of effect of what Vietnam did to our country and our mindset and our generation. And I think you're finally starting to see in popular culture that just sort of the craziness of the 2010s and then the 2020 through 2022 period of the pandemic and George Floyd and all of that being examined in ways that are kind of interesting and critical. Critics hated this movie, and I think they are wrong about it. It is a fascinating, flawed maybe, but very fascinating film about, again, just what did we do? What did it mean? What is the actual effect of all
how,
of this?
How are the classroom scenes when Julia Roberts, is she talking about Kierkegaard or Schlegel? Or how do they represent, well, I love, you know, movies about colleges when they try to make people sound intellectual, and it always sounds ridiculous.
Well, part of the point is she is clearly a very smart person who is intellectual, and also being that way is ridiculous. And so all of those scenes sort of revolve around her showing off her knowledge to her students and kind of delivering these, you know, great little monologues, right, about exactly what the meaning of morality and what we can draw from this. And, you know, kind of putting the students in their place. This movie is really mean to Yale students. Sorry, Catherine. But in a way that is allowing us to see that she is not a person of great character herself as she does this. Fascinating film, After the Hunt by Luca Guadagnino. I almost got it that time. All right, folks, that is our show. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That is reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. Reason Roundtable will return.